Hey, John.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm all excited because it's been really cold here all week, and this afternoon the Phillipstown Pond Hockey Association is convening for its first game.
Hockey Association?
Pond Hockey Association.
Pond Hockey. So that's like ice hockey?
Yeah. So this this is a group of people who, not the same people, of course, but there have been people in this area who've been playing pond hockey, especially on this one pond just about a half a mile from me, but on other ponds as well, for 60, 70 years.
Wow, that's great.
I've been doing it for about, I don't know, 12 years now.
Wow, who's the oldest person doing that, or how old is he?
The oldest guy is, his name is Lars Kulisade. He's a patent attorney in New York, and he's the meanest, toughest son of a bitch on the ice year after year. He's about 6 foot three, 220 pounds. He's I think he just turned 70. He's had a triple bypass operation, and you don't want to mess with Lars.
That sounds fun. It's actually frozen there already.
Oh yeah, it's it's been down in the 20s every night for the last 4 or 5 nights, and so it's quite cold. So we're going to meet today at Lake Alice at about 2:30. In fact, I don't have much time to spare, so I've already got my my uniform on.
Really, you're wearing it now?
Yeah.
Oh, good. It'll be a surprise for me when I see it.
Yeah, it's just this old black jersey that I've had for, geez, I don't know, almost 35 years or so.
You're not wearing a helmet, though.
Yeah.
God, you're so athletic, John.
Oh, well. Not really, but I pretend.
Well, that's good. That's good.
So
hey, you know, what were you going to say?
Oh, well, just, you know, what are we going to talk about?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't know if you wanted to start with anything in particular. I was going over the Stephen 70, your list of the 70 best science books of the century.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, it's really interesting. It's there's many, many titles that I agree with wholeheartedly, and there's some that I found a little puzzling, and some that I've written some annotations here. And
oh, great.
Yeah, I have about 10 suggested deletions and about 12 suggested additions that we could talk about a few of them anyway.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, run them by me.
Okay, well, it's a good list. I mean, it's very idiosyncratic, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's really the Horgan 70, right?
Well, it's completely the Horgan 70, and it's very skewed towards books that I've read. So,
well, yeah, I noticed there's like 5 drug books.
Yeah, you noticed that.
Yeah.
Well, some of them aren't completely drug books. So, for example, there's a book by the British psychologist Susan Blackmore.
Right, yeah.
And I mentioned that, and she is one of the world's most prominent studiers of parapsychology, and she was inspired to do that by this experience of astral projection in which she left her body after smoking marijuana when she was in college at Oxford. But that, you know, so I mentioned that episode, but the book really isn't about drugs at all.
I see.
It's just about...
it's about science, though, huh?
Yeah, it's about science. Yeah, about how she was a parapsychology believer, and then as a result of spending 10 or 15 years doing research trying to prove how ESP works, she became a non-believer.
Oh, okay. So maybe that's like maybe 4.5. But, okay. I mean, then you have Wade Davis here, you know, where he goes to the Amazon to explore psychotropic plants and anyway I was sort of struck by, if you're going to pick 70 books out of the whole century and 4.5 of them are drug books, maybe you're a little top heavy on drug books.
That's fair enough. You know, so for my last book, Rational Mysticism, I got back I revisited my youthful interest in psychedelic drugs and interviewed a bunch of psychedelic folks.
Yeah, and, so they're all on your bookshelf still.
That's right. And so it's just some of these books are, I think, deserve wider recognition. So everybody knows about Aldous Huxley's The Doors of Perception.
Doors of Perception. Yeah, my suggestion, I guess, would be, you know, that would be enough. But but it depends, you know, on, I mean, 70, yeah. Yeah, just a suggestion.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good one. I'll try to get the psychedelic nuts to come and defend some of these choices or add even more.
Maybe so. Yeah, I put check marks by the ones that I agreed with wholeheartedly, like Diane Ackerman's A Natural History of the Senses.
Oh, you're a Diane Ackerman fan.
I'd almost forgotten about that book. It's been so long. I only remember that it was really, really great writing.
Oh, she's fabulous. There was this period when she was writing a lot for The New Yorker.
Yeah.
In the, I guess it was in the early 90s, and she had these wonderful sort of nature adventure stories where she'd go out and find some scientist who was studying some exotic animal, bats or some kind of bird, and this wonderful, really sensual science writing. So, I wanted to get her on the list.
That's good, and that reminded me of some other things that it seemed to me should be on there, like Lives of the Cell.
Ah, yes.
Lewis Thomas.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's that's just wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful writing.
That's a classic. It's almost such a classic that I felt obliged to leave it off, because everybody would have that on their best list, and I wanted my list to be different. But
actually, I just switched the camera to Studio B, where I have a pile of the books that I would suggest might be included. I thought I'd just show it for a few minutes in case we don't get to talk about all of them, because people can see some of the titles. But so you agree Lewis Thomas might be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But actually, the one I wanted to be sure to mention that I just finished reading, which I actually am so enthusiastic about, at least at the moment, I think I'd say it's the best science book I've ever read.
Wow.
In fact, I think it may be the best single book I've ever read.
Oh, my God. What's that?
That's probably, you know, that's probably exaggerating, but I just haven't enjoyed a book so much for a long time. It was Oliver Sacks' Uncle Tungsten.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, you know, I love Oliver Sacks.
Oh, but this is completely different from anything else he's written.
I've read that, or at least I read a big chunk of it. The only problem is that I've got this rule about only one book.
Yeah, I know. In fact, I saw that, and I would suggest that this belongs on there instead of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
Really?
Even though everyone's heard of that book. And part of my reasoning is, you know, there's, you know, a certain amount of question about how much of the essays in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat are based on fact and how much are sort of embellishments.
Really?
And he says something about that himself in the beginning of the book, where something about a mix of fact and fable, or I can't remember how he put it, but it makes me wonder, especially, I mean, there's some of that stuff, like the chapter about the two twins that can supposedly generate prime numbers many, many digits long out of their heads there's no known practical algorithm for doing this.
I had forgotten that aspect of it, and I certainly had forgotten that, or didn't even realize that Sacks had admitted that it was...
Well, I don't think it was admission so much. I think that's just how he presented it. He's really a writer as much as he is a scientist, or really a writer more than a scientist, I think. But I think there's some question, not in any, in any way that... is bad or necessarily controversial, but it's just what kind of literary form it was, and maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's one thing that's very different about Uncle Tungsten. I mean, obviously he can't. And we should say that this book is a memoir that starts out in his childhood in England, and he describes falling in love with chemistry, and there's like these wonderful scenes, like when he goes into the British Science Museum in in Kensington and sees this room, or this wall, I guess, where they have the periodic table of the elements.
Yeah.
And a little compartment with each one of the actual elements, and how he slowly, you know, learns all of this amazing chemistry. And I learned so much chemistry from that book. It made me realize that chemistry is just suddenly now much more interesting to me than physics, which was always what I thought was so interesting because it was so basic. But
even
his chemistry in there is fantastic.
Even though Linus Pauling said that he basically wrapped up chemistry in 1930 when he described the chemical bond in quantum terms.
Yeah. Well, you could probably make that argument, but it's just such fascinating stuff. The way that the atomic structure of an element will be reflected in its real world macroscopic properties Sachs is just so wonderful at bringing that out, and just the childhood excitement of learning about science. So my suggestion would be to put that in instead of the man who mistook his wife for a hat.
Well, you know, this gets into the different criteria that we use for picking these books.
Yeah.
And Sachs is sort of known as somebody who has this really humanistic approach to neurology and psychiatry.
Right.
He has a case study approach, and so I see it as important that the books that he's had that focus on patients with different brain disorders are really important as a counterpoint to the conventional mode of psychiatry, which looks for commonalities.
Yeah.
Among patients, and
I can see why you put it on there, and they really both should be on there. But
yeah.
You know, if you have a rule about one, I can see how it would be difficult. But
thank you. Well, George, that's exactly the kind of thing that I hope that this list would get people to argue about. So,
Uncle Tungsten's great, and I was showing my pile, and I'll just read off some of the titles really quickly. You'd mentioned in your I think in your introduction to the list, and we should link to this again so people can refer to it, but the fact that you thought that your list was maybe a little top-heavy toward the end of the century.
Yes.
Yeah, and in that regard, there are some books I would suggest. You had Schrodinger's What is Life, but how about, you know, Heisenberg's Physics and Philosophy is just a wonderful classic, you know, where he describes, you know, hiking in the woods of Denmark with Niels Bohr and discussing quantum mechanics and, you know, having these big arguments with Einstein and.
Oh, really? So it's actually a memoir. I've got that somewhere here in the bookcase right behind me. I've just never read it. I just assumed that it was windy discourse on uncertainty.
No, not at all. It's basically, the first-hand account of someone who was right there on the front lines when they were inventing quantum mechanics.
Okay, read that. That would be a great inclusion.
Oh, it's really gripping. There's actually two of them. There's Physics and Philosophy, and the second one is Physics and Beyond. But Physics and Philosophy is the real. I mean, there's all just wonderful scenes with Bohr and Heisenberg and Einstein are the ones that I particularly remember.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what else. Oh, and then Arthur Koestler's The Sleepwalkers.
I don't know.
That's a wonderful
book. What's that book about?
It's a history of astronomy, basically, starting out with the, you know, a little bit about the pre-Socratics and the Greeks, but the real, and then getting into Ptolemy and Copernicus and Kepler, and finally it ends with Galileo.
Mm-hmm.
But the portraits, especially the chapter on Kepler, is just absolutely wonderful. It just brings that whole time to life of Kepler, you know, hanging out in the Uraniborg, the castle observatory that Tycho Brahe had on the island there in, off the water in Denmark, and, you know, figuring out the, you know, what was weird about the orbits of Mars, and then, you know, coming upon his wonderful system. And one thing you learn from reading this book is that, you know, Copernicus's original heliocentric version of the universe, you know, since he insisted on using perfect circles for the orbits, which everyone just assumed you had to do, that it really had as many epicycles and little embellishments as Ptolemy's system did with the Earth in the center, just to make it comport with the observation. So, of course, it was, you know, I mean, it's actually well known that Kepler's making the orbits elliptical is what straightened it out, but Kessler just really makes that argument come alive and looks at it in just amazing amount of detail. I mean, you learn all about epicycles and tangents and what was the other term? I forget at the moment, but it's really a great chapter. And then the one on Galileo is great too. And the impression you really get when you come through this is you think less of Copernicus and way less of Galileo, but Kepler's really the hero.
This
really set off Owen Gingrich, because it was Kessler that referred to Copernicus's book De Revolutionibus as the book that nobody read.
And then
Owen set out to prove that, well, actually, a lot of people read it, and he tracked down every known copy on the face of the earth and looked at the annotations and then wrote his own wonderful book, The Book That Nobody Read, which I would also suggest be on the list.
The only unfortunate thing about this is that now you're making me feel obliged to go off and read these books. in addition to all the big stack of books that I already have that I'm supposed to be reading.
Oh, I know. No, there are a lot of things on your list that I haven't read, and I'm already have them on my mental list of things to read as well. I'll mention a few others. Timothy Ferris's Coming of Age in the Milky Way.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful book.
Yeah, I just, Ferris has this kind of grand style that puts me off. What can I say?
But if you're not going to have that on there, and you're going to have something like,
I have Lonely Hearts
really
of the Cosmos. There's some
really obscure stuff. Yeah, that's a great book, too.
Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos, for some reason... Dennis, I mean,
No, it's a wonderful book.
He covers some of the same
things. That shouldn't be on there, but how can you not have a book by Timothy Ferris?
I don't know. It's just...
you should call this Horgan 70. You really should.
Yeah, I know I should.
I mean, if you're going to... let's see. There was a couple on here that... You know, I mean, Thomas Nagel is he's a great essayist, and his essay, What Is It Like to Be a Bat, is really... interesting and important, but you know, it's really basically a book of philosophy, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got a few philosophers on there, so I've got Thomas Kuhn on there.
Yeah, well, Kuhn, that's more directly philosophy of science, and certainly Popper, but is Nagel really?
True. Nagel is, it's questionable, and some of the essays in that book aren't, really don't address science at all.
Yeah.
It's just that essay is referenced so often and has played such a big role in the whole debate over whether science or consciousness can be scientifically reduced that I just thought I should put it on here. But that one, I've got to admit, is pretty questionable.
Yeah, I think there's some, you know, I mean, if you needed to make room, I mean, I'm sure all of these are worthy books. I also suggested Julian Jaynes.
So many people have suggested that. So this is...
The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind.
So many people have suggested it. I've got it. I first read it, I think, more than 20 years ago. It keeps coming back, even though...
It's a real mind-blower.
Really, it's sort of this great work of pseudoscience.
I don't think it's pseudoscience. So it's highly speculative, so I could see arguments against... not including it, but you know, you have some stuff. I mean, you have David Bohm's Wholeness in the Implicate Order.
Yeah, that's
pretty... talk about pseudoscience, highly speculative.
Well,
I mean,
except that David Bohm was somebody who did work that arguably deserved a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, but
as
the
really
book,
a great physicist.
Well, what's the writing like?
It's very squishy.
Your own criteria says that the books stand up for their subject matter, rhetorical style, and impact.
It's been enormously influential even if only in ways that aren't necessarily
no, but not. But what about the rhetorical style? You have three criteria, so I had assumed that each book.
Oh no, would, you don't have to meet every one of those.
But, oh, I see. So that's you know, how so Chomsky gets on there.
Yeah, so some of them might be have a greater cultural impact, oh. but their scientific merits might be less, or their rhetorical yeah. qualities well, might be less.
It so seems it was, like if you don't. Demand that the rhetorical style be one of the criteria for one of the criteria for every book. That then you sort of lapse into having a list of you know the Stephen 70 great ideas or great influential scientific thinkers instead of the actual books.
Well, that's true to an extent. I guess Bohm. I find him. So I interviewed him. For a profile in the early 90s, just before, I think literally a month before he died. And he was just, he was somebody who really was obsessed by the kind of spiritual implications of quantum mechanics, yeah. but in a way that wasn't shallow, as most of this type of thinking is. It was, he really was a brilliant physicist, and this kind of tortured soul, and the ambiguities in his writing, I just find fascinating. Instead of just sort of flaky and
well, maybe
and,
yeah, well, maybe the rhetorical style is there. I haven't actually read the book. I've just read about Bohm. So.
Yeah,
but I just wondered, and I really wondered about Chomsky when you. Include, I mean, you described it as kind of a grab bag of lectures, transcripts, odds and ends. I mean, that to me isn't really a book.
Well, it's just, there are some ideas in that book that have been very influential. It's one of the more accessible collections of his writings.
Yeah, and I can see that. And I guess my hang-up is that I think that the book should all be, if not, you know, well or... well-written or, you know, creatively written, that they should, you know, at least be clearly written.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, I think some of some of the pieces in there are very clearly written.
Yeah.
So he's got a, again, this is a book that's had a big impact on the whole debate over consciousness. So it's in that book where he argues that consciousness probably is not a solvable problem. So he distinguishes between problems which are solvable at least in principle and mysteries which are not solvable in principle. And he describes consciousness as a mystery, and he explains why he thinks of it that way.
Okay.
So I think it's really an important and interesting book. And he's obviously one of the great intellectuals of our era.
Yeah,
so,
that's true. I mean, if it's...
I wanted to stick them on.
It's hard. It's just really hard to...
I might have to take some of these off, George. Boy, you're really,
I should say you've got... There's a few overlaps that I... Like Horace Freeland Judson's The Eighth Day of Creation. That actually may be the single best book ever written about science.
Wow, I would never say that about it.
Oh, are you kidding? That is just... Especially the first part. I almost sometimes think he should have brought that out as three different books because it's in three sections. And the first of three book-length sections, the first of which is just this wonderful reenactment of Watson and Crick and the discovery of the double helix. But,
right.
You know, but going way back to the beginning, like with the Waring blender experiment and Erwin Chargaff with, we found that... the amount of A and C and T and G were, you know, the ratios were constant in the nucleic acids that he was, you know, he just had these soups of nucleic acids he was studying without having any sense of structure or what the structure might mean. God, I just think it's just wonderful, wonderful writing. And obviously the first part of the book benefited from the fact that it was serialized in the New Yorker, so they got, you know, got edited by the New Yorker.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. I first read this when it came out in the New Yorker, and I remember sitting up at my parents' cabin in the Hamas Mountains with my girlfriend at the time on Christmas vacation from graduate school, and sitting by the fireplace and just staying up until late at night just reading this thing, just thinking. I mean, I think it might be the one book that you know, along with Watson's The Double Helix, it really kind of pushed me over the edge into wanting to become a science writer.
God, what a wonderful tribute to the book.
And I have to mention another book that's very similar to that, which is Kreese and Mann's The Second Creation.
Yes, I haven't read it, but I know of it.
It's great. I mean, they basically took Judson as sort of their inspiration and then did the same thing with the history of particle physics in the 20th century, and it's just beautifully, beautifully written.
Well, I think it's obvious, George, that you should be compiling the George Johnson greatest science books of all time.
Well, one of them that would be on there that's also in my pile in Studio B is The End of Science.
Oh, shocks.
No, and I know the only reason it's not on there is because you couldn't put it on there because you were making the list. But,
yeah.
You know.
Well,
I mean, that
thanks.
Meets my criteria. Not only is it's influential, it's interesting, and it's well-written.
Well, thanks. I appreciate
it. And it certainly has had an impact, even though a lot of the impact was really to make people angry.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well,
but,
or
know,
to provoke them, to challenge them.
It challenged them, yeah. So, I mean, that to me meets all three of the criteria. I guess the only other one I'd mention was with Feynman, I would pick his book QED instead of the one that you did, but
I've got about six different Feynman books, and so there are some people who have said that it should have been surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman.
Yeah.
The kind of jokey.
Yeah, that's the one that Murray Gell-Mann called Dick's Joke Book. And it's not, you know, it's kind of quirky and fun, and in some ways it's nice because it brings out, you know, his boyhood excitement at taking apart radios and things, but
mm-hmm.
And you know, and the whole heart-wrenching thing with his wife dying, and
yeah, it's more about his life than about his science. That's for sure.
QED, the strange theory of light and matter, is just a masterpiece of scientific explication.
Yeah.
But, of course, none of his books are really... He didn't write them. I mean, he basically talked them, and,
right.
And then they were transcribed, and then... And I think, you know, I think rather lightly edited. But,
yeah. Well, he was just... He made quantum mechanics as comprehensible as it can be, given that it is intrinsically incomprehensible.
Right, as he well... put. And, oh, and one more I see actually at the top of the pile, The Universe and Dr. Einstein. Do you know that by Lincoln Barnett?
No.
That to me is the best book about Einstein and relativity that I've ever read. It's a short little book, and Einstein actually wrote a foreword for it. And I just remembered it recently. I read an essay for one of these books that John Brockman put together on Einstein, and it was called The Books in the Basement, and I was writing about, you know, learning about Einstein through popular science, and
mm-hmm.
and this is the book. I'll hold it up, and I think this also appeared. I think this might have been serialized in the Atlantic Monthly or Harper's or something.
Now, is this better than? So there are. I've heard from some people who said that it's a travesty that I don't have Einstein's own explanation of relativity.
Well, yeah, there was that book that he wrote with, what's his name, Leopold somebody, and it's good. Yeah, it's really good, and I know you have Isaacson's Einstein biography, but I'm not sure that that's really the best one.
Yeah, you don't think so? That was.
Well, I thought the other one that came out at almost the same time, the one by Jürgen Neffe.
Yeah, you like that? I thought that sort of looking back at the two of them. So we both reviewed these two books
right.
when they came out, whenever that was, 3-4 months ago.
Yeah, we talked about it, I think.
Yeah, and I just felt that, especially after a little passage of time, that I think the Neffe book was in some ways sort of quirkier and more interesting and had unexpected views of certain aspects of Einstein's life.
Yeah.
But if I was going to recommend just... If somebody could just read one book about Einstein that really gave an overview of his entire scientific and political and personal life, that the Isaacson book would really do a good job.
Yeah, so, it's a good book. And it might be worth going back and looking that Ronald Clark's biography of Einstein, which was kind of the classic one before the two recent ones. I mean, I'm not counting Abraham Pice's, which is really not something you can just sit down and read.
Right.
Unless you're a physicist.
And physicists than for regular folks.
Yeah. But anyway, those are just some of my thoughts. If you go to the Stephen 75, or maybe drop a few of the drug books, and or there was a political science book, and
I can't drop that.
Yeah,
I feel very, because it's this is a book by it's actually a trilogy by the political scientist Gene Sharp on
nonviolence. I know you're really interested in nonviolence and war, but you said in your annotation is political science science? I vote yes, and what I wrote in the margin was I vote no. you could have a whole separate list of Stephen's 70 influential political science books of the century. So,
well, this is because I've been thinking about how science can help us solve the problem of war, and this guy's work, Gene Sharp's work, is one of the best examples of addressing war as an empirical problem, bringing data to bear from history to show that there are ways it can be solved. One of the ways is to convince people that nonviolent political activism is just more effective in the short term and the long term than violence.
Well, it sounds like an important book. I just question whether it belongs on the science.
Oh, it's definitely questionable. List. But it's my list.
I know. It's the Horgan 70.
Yeah.
But just a few more that I just agree with wholeheartedly. Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene is just blows me away every time I go back to it. Daniel Dennett's Consciousness Explained, Freeman Dyson's Infinite in All Directions, and Stephen Jay Gould's Wonderful Life is another one of my absolute favorites. James Gluck's Chaos, of course. And really great stuff on here.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping, as I said, the whole point of it was to, you've given me better feedback than I've gotten from everybody else combined so far.
Well, it's easier when I have you on the phone here, and don't have to, have to write blog comments.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I think it's really a wonderful, wonderful salutary, is that the word?
Something like that.
Effort, yeah.
I
imagine it's something that will, is it going to be in ferment, constant ferment? Or?
Yeah, I think, you're already making me, I think I might have to change some of the entries and go back and look at some of the books that you mentioned and if we keep changing it, then it gives us an excuse to keep reintroducing it and get more commentary.
Right. No, I mean, it's fun to have it as kind of a touchstone to, to talk about science books, which don't get talked about enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. Yeah. I appreciate it. So, listen,
there was actually something. We were going to talk about science this time, weren't we?
Yeah. Hey, you want to talk about this really important controversy with intense feeling on all sides that is just rocking the country right now?
What is that?
That is cat lovers versus bird lovers fighting over whether cats should be allowed to kill little birdies.
Yeah, I think it may be too late, but...
Well, there's something that can be done about it. That's sort of the story.
You need a form of rehabilitation or reasoning with them?
No, just shooting the cats. So this is...
Well, why don't you reprise? There was there was a really good story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine.
It was good. Was it just last Sunday, I guess?
I think so.
Yeah.
What was the deal?
So apparently about a year ago in Galveston, Texas, I think it is.
Yeah.
A coastal town in Texas. There is an avid bird watcher named Jim Stevenson, who picked off a feral cat that was stalking plovers on, I guess the cats were hiding under this underpass, which was right next to a stretch of shore where plovers were nesting.
Yeah, and, kind of an estuary, wasn't it?
Yeah, okay. And so this guy, Stevenson, I mean, he knows that feral cats are responsible for the deaths of millions and millions of birds, many of them endangered around the country, and he just couldn't stand to see this, so he picked off this cat one day.
Yeah, he just shot it.
Yeah, he shot the cat with a .22, and there was, and this was right next to this overpass, there was a toll station on top of the overpass, and a toll collector saw this guy shoot the cat and started screaming and yelling at him, and then actually chased him and tracked him down and got him arrested for illegally, supposedly, shooting the cat.
And yeah, so and apparently the strong implication of the article was that this wasn't the first of this guy's cats that he'd... I mean, they were basically... The toll housekeeper was feeding them and keeping them as pets.
Right. Well, not...
I mean, I guess he could have shot the toll housekeeper, too. You know, that would have, you know, really eliminated the problem.
Well, so, you know, it... George, are you a cat person?
Well, kind of. I mean, I never would have expected, you know... I never wanted cats, but, you know, two cats just kind of, you know, moved into the house and took over, and I really like them, and that really bothered me that this guy would... It bothers me that cats kill birds, I guess, but it also bothers me that some rational thinking human being with the power to make moral choices would take it upon himself to do this vigilante thing and shoot these cats.
But
I mean, it's not like the cats can think, oh, well, it's morally wrong for me to kill these plovers. You know, it's wired in, but this was a human being who could make choices, and... you know, there are many things he could have done that would have been within the realm of law and moral law to confront this problem. So
like
I thought
what?
That was
what could he have done other than shoot the cat? Now the article said that
he could have met the toll keeper at the bridge and said, look, you know, there's really a problem here with encouraging these cats, and how about if I help you? You know, round them up and we'll, you know, bring them and find homes for them or bring them to the shelter or something like that. He could have talked to this guy.
He had tried to trap the cats, according to the article.
Yeah.
And had failed.
Yeah.
And so this was a desperate measure, and I guess he felt that he needed to do something right away, although it did seem to be somewhat of a symbolic gesture since there are still lots of cats. I mean, even in the present, there are still lots of cats in this area. Let me just tell you where my perspective on this comes from.
But you should mention for people that don't know that, you know, your wife's bird rehabilitation efforts and your flight cage in the back. So I assume that you'd be on the side of the birds.
Yeah, I am on the side of the birds, and I mean, I am sincerely, but I also have to be, because if I wasn't, then I would probably be exterminated by my own wife. So Susie she takes care of these wild birds that are brought to her that are injured, and many of the birds that are brought to her have been mangled by cats. In fact, one of the ugliest scenes you can see in my house is when somebody comes to our front door with a shoebox with a purple finch in it, and they say, oh, we found this bird in front of our house, and, you know, it's, something has happened to it. And Susie will take one look at the bird, and she'll go, do you have a cat? And they'll say, yeah. And Susie says, your cat found that you took this bird from your cat, right? And they'll go, yeah. And then Susie will get this look in her eyes and tell them, you cannot let your cat go outside and prey on birds. She'll say, this cat is basically already dead because it's going to be infected by the bacteria-ridden claws and teeth of your horrible animal. The thing that really sets her off is when people, and this is pretty common, people have bird feeders.
Yeah. And then they have cats.
Birds come, and then they have cats, and they let the cats out, and the cats pick off the birds as they arrive at the bird feeders. And the people just go, oh, well, that's just sort of nature's way. And of
nature
course,
red in tooth and claw.
Right,
but no, I think that's a problem. In fact, we had a bird feeder, but then when we ended up getting adopted by these two cats, we got rid of the bird feeder because we didn't want it to become a cat feeder.
Right.
But no, it really bothers me when it's really rare that these two cats around here kill birds because they're pretty passive. And I thought for a while they were vegetarians, but they're not. And it really bothers me when they corner a rabbit and they'll just torment it for hours unless you discover them and chase them away. And so it bothers me, but what are you going to do? I mean, the reason the cat, I guess the argument is that cats don't belong here. They belong back in Egypt and scratching around in the desert, and they shouldn't have been introduced into this ecosystem. So they're really like these mammalian weeds, aggressive mammalian weeds. But on the other hand, they didn't choose to come over here. They basically were, hung out on ships to kill the rats, and then they jumped ship, and then they started breeding, and here they are. But
So the issue is for Susie when it comes to house cats, she just says keep your cat indoors.
Yeah, but you can't. No one who has cats. I mean, there's some cats, I guess, that were maybe born in captivity that you could do that. But that to me is as cruel to the cat as it is cruel to the bird to be eaten by the cat.
Oh, I don't know. I think most people I know who have cats do keep their cats indoors. Certainly anybody who's a friend of my wife's, they keep their cat indoors, or at least they tell her.
Cats are indoors most of the time. But see, these cats, the story is they were born in the wild. We live pretty near the edge of town, and sometime in the distant past, someone must have had some really beautiful Persian and Himalayan cats, and that escaped or got thrown into an arroyo or something. And then, so there's this colony of these strays, but they're just these incredibly beautiful strays with all these Himalayan markings. And and there was this one, the mother used to show up at our back door, 10 years ago, and then, my wife started putting out food for her, and she came again and again, and then one day she showed up with these two kittens. And one was white and one was black, and they started hanging out. So what eventually happened was, we decided to adopt the two kittens. The mother went away and disappeared, and then we had them spayed and got all their little shots and things. But then later, before the mother disappeared, she came back and had another litter of kittens in our shed. So we ended up adopting one of those. So it's like the half sister of the other cats, and then gave up the other ones for adoption. But then more and more cats kept coming around. All these cousins, the word would get out that you could get a free meal over here, and they would come. And then I got one of those live traps, and I started trapping them because the population pressure was really getting just to be too bad. It was just terrible. So I would trap them and bring them into the animal shelter, and then they would, keep them there supposedly for adoption, but, there's always many more cats than they can give away, so they end up going into the cat grinder.
So your objection is to shooting cats specifically as opposed to having them euthanized in the ASPCA?
I think there's definitely there's obviously too many feral cats, and they do need to be reduced, but it bothers me that someone would take it upon himself to just go out with a gun on land that was not his and shoot someone's cat who turned out to be kind of a semi-pet.
Well,
you just don't do that.
As a backdrop to this, we should mention that there has been this precipitous decline in especially songbird populations in the United States.
Yeah, but
now,
it's not really, I mean,
no,
another thing that this article pointed out, that the main reason for that is not cats. They're just kind of,
That's the main reason is habitat loss, because humans are the ultimate invasive species.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but
puts it perfectly.
Cats are a significant part of the problem.
Yeah, and they are now, because we've reduced all of this natural habitat. So now there's what's little left is squeezing out the birds, and it's made the cat problem worse. But so obviously we're not going to regain habitat for the birds. So instead you go out to Kmart and buy a rifle and go out and shoot people's pets.
Well, that's one solution, but the other solution is convincing people that they need to keep their cats indoors. Cats are not an endangered species. They're an invasive species. Most cats, if they're kept indoors, they don't need to eat birds because they're being fed by their owners. So the idea that it's natural for the cats to go out and pick off birds is just... it's just stupid.
It's wired in. I mean, our cats are fed, but
they'll go out
and they'll occasionally try to get a bird, and we always discourage them. And maybe, you know, maybe once or twice a year, one of them will actually succeed in getting a bird.
How about if I let my dog go and chase your cat and eat your cat? Is that just part of the great circle of life, too?
No, I don't think it'd be good, but I wouldn't shoot your dog.
Well, you'd have every right to shoot my dog.
No, I wouldn't. I mean, if it were on my property, I suppose I...
Oh, you definitely... Well, around here, you definitely would.
I'm not a big property rights guy, though.
I just worry,
don't you think there's something about a hierarchy of consciousness, too, in beings? I mean, anyone who has a cat, you know, knows that there's a glimmer or a flicker of some sort of consciousness there that I rather doubt is in most
birds. Don't say it. Oh, my God. Susie, Peter Berg, and
with their parrot Alex has shown how incredibly intelligent these birds can be. But
George, if you could meet the crows in this cage right next to my office, you wouldn't say that. They have at least as much personality as cats do. To me, it really is a question of looking at the bird population and how fragile it is and how the populations are declining, and then looking at cats overall. It's not a problem that there aren't enough cats. They are more than protected. They're taken care of.
That's not my argument.
But that's, I think, the proper way to look at this. We've got to do anything that we can to stop the cats. Well, I think shooting the cat, unless you think that hunting is wrong in general, and that was another point made in this article, shooting cats is a humane way of stopping the problem, or maybe trapping them and taking them to be euthanized at the ASPCA.
Trapping them wouldn't bother me.
You know, what's interesting, an ethical twist.
And if I can trap cats, this guy can trap cats, because I'm not exactly, you know, the great hunter, but if I can figure out how to trap stray cats, this guy could have done the same
thing. It did say that he's tried. But,
yeah,
you know,
he didn't try very hard. He just wanted to get out there and shoot some cats because he was pissed off.
I don't know. I thought he was a heroic figure the way I read this. The interesting ethical twist for my wife is that she rehabilitates raptors. Mm-hmm. So she rehabilitates... she just had sharp-shinned hawk. It's one of these little, very agile woodland hawks. They basically prey on songbirds.
Yeah.
But in this case, the argument that, well, it's only natural means something. It does. Mm-hmm. That argument is totally fatuous when it comes to cats, which are, you know, there's nothing natural about cats in this country anymore.
Oh, you mean just because they don't belong here and the raptors do?
Right. So it's, you know, it is sort of
funny. So it's okay for the raptors to kill little birds.
Right. Well,
because I'm trying to sort out the moral calculus here.
Well,
why is it okay for the raptors to kill the birds? Because the raptors were here naturally because God put them here in the
North American
continent, and they didn't come here from... Egypt and Africa. And
the raptors kill just for food. One of the points that this article also makes is that cats, whether house cats or feral cats, kill indiscriminately. They kill for fun. They kill much more than they need to eat. So it has this one story about.
Oh, so it's not. So it's like this evil thing.
It is evil. Cats are evil.
But if they, whatever they do, I mean, by definition, it's natural. I mean.
Well, no. The house cats in this country aren't natural. I mean, our dog
isn't cats,
natural.
You don't think cats kill birds in the wild?
Sure they do, but those cats are here for totally artificial reasons.
You mean, yeah, because they're an invasive species.
Right.
But and boy, once you start,
and all feral
you know.
Cats are descended originally from house cats. And
yeah,
I think
right.
the biggest problem that my wife is concerned about and is trying to fix is domesticated cats that people let out.
Yeah.
I think this is the largest, by far the largest part of the cat population, more than feral cats, that people let out, and these cats are being fed indoors, and then they go out and kill birds basically just for sport. That just doesn't make any sense.
Bad kitty. Maybe you could reason with them. Or...
Oh, my God, this is great, Jared. This is the first thing that we have really disagreed on, but I feel like you're just sort of... you're trying to goad me in that you really don't you don't care about cats that much because you couldn't because you're
no,
a reasonable
you know, person. I like our cats. I don't like cats in general. You know, I like certain cats. I don't like dogs in general. I like certain dogs. But you know, I like to look at birds, and you know, I'm not a particularly hummingbirds. And it was very distressing when one of our cats killed a hummingbird.
Ah.
We were watching it in the yard, and we saying, oh, isn't that cute? You know, Marvel thinks she's going to get that hummingbird. What a joke. Because
she's
a pretty sluggish cat. And then suddenly just grabs it right out of the air. So,
oh, God. That makes me sick.
Yeah, I didn't like that either. But these cats probably spend 90% of their time indoors, but they were born in the wild, and you just can't keep them in the house all the
time. Should, you know, Andy Revkin, the New York Times writer... Mm-hmm. Who happens to live right here in Garrison, down the road from me and Susie, he blogged on this cats versus birds.
Yeah, what was his take?
Story. In fact, the title of his piece is Cat Fight, and he's just neutral. He has the URL of the Times story, also of a couple of websites on both sides of the controversy, but he also... talked to Susie about the whole issue and quoted her saying in her most Susie-esque fashion what she thinks of people who have house cats and let them out to prey on birds. So I'll post a link to
it. Yeah, I'll take a look. I mean, I guess the bottom line is I'm probably fairly neutral, but I don't think you should go out and shoot people's pets. And I also, well, another aspect that I think is kind of interesting that I have to think about is, again, just this degrees of consciousness. There was this really neat section in Douglas Hofstadter's recent book, I Am a Strange Loop. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about what he defined as a soul, which, you know, he didn't mean in any mystical kind of sense, but sort of this... having this glimmer of neurological awareness, and how, you know, it was clear that, you know, we believe that, you know, people have this thing that, you know, he calls soulfulness, and that maybe, you know, a chimpanzee or a bonobo would have it to somewhat lesser degree, and then you go down the hierarchy with, you know, dogs and cats and mice, and, you know, and birds would be somewhere in the continuum, you know, and then you get down to spiders and grasshoppers. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you upset that our cats kill grasshoppers?
You really are trying to goad me. No,
no
I don't have
that's
any.
Okay.
As far as I know, grasshoppers aren't an endangered species, George.
Oh, okay. The cats should know that. Yeah.
No, but we know it.
Yeah.
And we're the ones.
Okay, so
the
I can see if the argument is that it would be better for people first to, if you have cats, to have them spayed so they don't reproduce
absolutely.
You know, in ridiculous numbers. And if you can, to try to keep them inside. I would contend that that's
and
not
by the
possible
way,
with all
bells.
Cats. But
bells
but
don't the, work. A collar with bells, because cats very quickly learn how to stalk birds so that the bells don't
ring. They
do,
yeah. The cats are really smart.
Yeah.
That's one thing that's really impressive about them. Yeah, but you can't. You know, you're acting as though they're these moral agents, and they're just cats.
No, no, it's the humans who are the moral agents. Yeah. That's the cats. I agree. Yeah. They can't.
Okay, I can see the argument that maybe people, you know, given the choices, they should have other pets than cats. But I think that probably the bigger problem is all this is the huge population of feral cats. I mean, it certainly is around here. And I think probably a better way to address the problem is to encourage people to use live traps and trap these cats and bring them into the shelter where they'll be spayed if anyone adopts them. And then, you know, there'll still be another cat in the world, but it's not going to, the population isn't going to be increasing exponentially.
That's a good idea. The even the cat lovers, there's something called the Alley Cats Allies for Alley Cats or something like this.
Yeah.
This that Andy Repkin mentions on
on his blog.
And they right. But then
I could see that.
Then re-releasing. So it's the re-releasing part that would bother me, because I don't think you realize how serious the problem of songbird decline is. It really is. It's
maybe I don't.
It's really very troubling. Bluebirds, when I was growing up, there were bluebirds all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are vanishingly rare. We actually have a couple who nest in a field next to us, but that's very unusual. So
But again, a lot of it's because of all those houses built
then,
there in the Hudson Valley.
But then the cats are part of the problem, and that's something that we can actually address fairly quickly.
Anyway,
the interesting thing is I realized that, you know, you sort of got blue states versus red states, and, you know, bush haters and bush lovers, and cat people versus bird people.
There's not a whole lot of overlap.
That's a real fault line. America.
Yeah, maybe that's how we can. Maybe the election will swing on that.
Yeah, you know, very quickly.
We could ask the candidates if they where they stand on the cat versus bird issue.
Right.
Which brings us to.
Yeah, so you know Chris Mooney, the science writer who wrote Republican War on Science, and he's a prolific blogger. He just wrote a book about the science of big storms and hurricanes. Well, he and Larry Krauss, the physicist, and some other people are trying to put together this movement to encourage the presidential candidates to have a debate that focuses on science.
Yeah, right.
So,
this is Lawrence Krauss, right, who we talked about last week in a different context.
What do you think?
So this is basically just a... I looked at the website when you mentioned it, and it's kind of a petition saying that, you know, the candidate should be discussing science and technological progress and the terrible educational gap in the United States and our dependence on importing foreign scientific talent that may, you know, not be possible as the dollar gets weaker and weaker and as these other economies become stronger and stronger and can, you know, keep these people in their own country. And yeah, I mean, it's obviously this huge issue that no one's really addressing, I guess, in the presidential campaign. So yeah, I don't see how anyone could be against that.
Oh, I could see how a lot of people would be against it.
Because they didn't believe in science, or
it seemed to be me, the way that Krauss phrased it in this op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, it seemed to be that he wanted to sort of embarrass candidates who didn't reject creationism and embrace the theory of evolution and the scientific outlook in general. There's something that, first of all, I signed this petition that Mooney was sending around because I don't know, I thought it's an interesting idea. I'm a little uncomfortable when scientists band together in the same way that when atheists band together, they sort of develop these collective bullying qualities. And there was a little whiff of that in the proposal that I saw. I'm not sure that focusing on science as something kind of isolated from all the other issues that politicians have to deal with, or especially a president would have to deal with, is necessarily a great thing. So I'm a little ambivalent.
So you think it should just be part of like a general discussion about the economic strength of the United States and how, you know, this is, you know, part of this is having an educated workforce, including people who are trained as engineers and scientists,
and the
public that understands basic science and can make rational choices based on what we really know about nature, as opposed to, you know, what people think they know.
Well, you know, that this certainly, these issues came up in the last election, so I remember Bush and Kerry debating stem cells.
Yeah.
For example, it feels like science is acting like any other special interest group. I'm curious to see how they succeed once this proposal becomes official. I guess it's going to be next week. I would love to see. You know, when I first saw this from Chris, I'm thinking, wow, that getting the presidential candidates. Opinions on scientific issues. And I was thinking, asking Rudy Giuliani about string theory or Hillary Clinton about what do you think about this wacky multi-universe theory of quantum cosmology? That would be, and they'd be kind of,
maybe they read Lee Smolin's book, Peter White's book. Yeah. I was amazed when I was in Santa Barbara about a year ago, doing the science writer in residence thing at the Kobly Institute for Theoretical Physics, and I went to a party that was given by some wealthy people out in Montecito.
Yeah,
and this is where Oprah has her big place, and just incredible wealth. But this party was actually it was sort of a benefit for the institute, and they got together people who were donors or maybe potential donors, and then Tom Siegfried, do you know him?
Oh, God,
Science writer. Yeah, Tom was there, you know, and he just had a book that came out, and he was reading from the book and having a discussion about science. It was kind of a science salon in Montecito.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting, but then during this, I was standing in the kitchen with Joe Polchinski, uh-huh. who's one of the most important string theorists. And he was confronted by this guy who was, you know, some investor, you know, some wealthy Montecito investor, I guess, who had just read Lee Smolin's book and was grilling him about superstring theory and saying, well, yeah, but, you know, there's no way, this isn't falsifiable, right? You know, and then I thought, wow, this is amazing. You know, here's poor Joe Polchinski who, you know, goes to this party. He's a serious theorist, and suddenly random people from the public are coming forth and grilling him about the meaning of superstring theory and whether it's this huge waste of time.
That's good. It'll probably.
I thought, wow. So maybe, you know, the candidates can get into this,
right? And if they if they go, this really, boy, this just sounds like the superstrings theory. I read a little bit about it. I read something that this guy George Johnson wrote about it, and it really just sounds like total bullshit to me.
They might say, wow, this is just what we need to be doing. And
yeah.
I bet Al Gore could say something.
Al Gore, I'm sure, does know about string theory.
Oh, yeah.
Al Gore used to write about, I mean, he's been to the Santa Fe Institute, I think.
Yeah, he has.
He certainly knows what they're doing there. In fact, I remember in one of his books, he talked about Per Bach's theory of self-organized criticality.
Right, right. Yeah, the late Per Bach.
Yeah.
Hey, well, that'll be a whole other show, so I guess we should probably wrap up here. How long have we
Garage Band Science time.
I'm going to do a real quick Garage Band Science.
All right.
Okay, so I'll switch over here to Studio B again.
Keep those cats indoors, George.
Right. You know, one of the best things I really like about cats as pets is that they're unconscious like 85% of the time.
Well, so are we.
Yeah, but even more so. Okay, see, I have to remove the books here, and then there's this huge looming object that's becoming visible as I take away the Tower of Suggested Reading. And it's this big tube about 18 inches high called a Greinacher tube, which is named after Heinrich Greinacher, another Swiss physicist. And there's very little, he doesn't have a Wikipedia article about him in English. There is one in German.
Uh-huh.
And I can link to a translation.
Oh, I think we've probably, the erudite Science Saturday audience, I'm sure, will be able to.
Well, yeah, I would encourage one of them to take the German article and use Google Translation and clean it up for the English site. But okay, now, the Greinacher tube. It's, again, it has two little electrodes on the bottom, and it's hooked up to a source of high voltage. And when I switch it on, I don't know if you can. Can you hear anything?
No.
That's probably not picking it up. There's this neat ringing sound. And what's happening is there's this spark gap in the tube. So it's basically these two metal rods that stick up inside the tube, going from the bottom to the top, and then they kind of angle out. And it's a spark gap, so you're putting like 5,000 volts across them. And at the bottom of the tube, this will cause the air to ionize, and a current will flow, and then the air will glow the same sort of indigo color that it does. It's mostly a vacuum, but just enough air to get this ionization and this glow. Mm-hmm. And then it immediately produces this heat, and as heat rises, it causes the plasma jet to rise up to the top of the tube, and then the connection's broken, and then it starts over at the bottom. So it looks like something you see in Frankenstein movies.
Ah,
it's actually sometimes called a Jacob's ladder,
uh-huh.
which is from the book of Genesis, actually, where Jacob sees this ladder on which the angels are ascending and descending from heaven.
Sounds very mystical.
On this particular Jacob's ladder, the angels are only ascending, so mm-hmm. I don't know what that means. So, anyway, behold the Greinacher tube.
As usual, I can't wait to see it.
I know, it must be very abstract, just hear my bad verbal descriptions.
No, your descriptions are wonderful. I mean, always visualize it without even seeing it.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm not sure I would be able to do that, but okay, I'm going to switch back now, and then we can wrap up, and we got a little bit of science in here. But,
yeah.
You know.
See if the cat and bird people come out on Blogging Heads the way they did on Andy Repkin's blog. He just got a flood of comments.
Oh, really?
You know, totally irrational comments from the cat people, and very enlightened, intelligent comments from the bird people. It was quite striking.
Huh. I don't believe you.
All right, George.
There are smart cat people out there.
I'm sure you're going to have some coming out and supporting your side. So I will talk to you, I guess not next week. I think
I think Carl has something, which will be good.
Carl Zimmer has another great chat coming up, I think.
Excellent.
Next week, and then maybe I'll see you 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, that sounds good. And yeah, perfect.
All right.
Okay. Well, good luck with the ice hockey.
Thank you. Can't wait.
Yeah, be careful out there.
I will.
Okay.
Bye, George.
Bye.